This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We've got to stop them. They're going to kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Red, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome. This is Truth Jihad Radio Special Live Edition, broadcasting out of the old ice cream trailer in the woods somewhere in western Wisconsin. For a while, we'll be moving to Morocco soon. I will keep my listeners posted on that. Meanwhile, you are listening to Revolution.Radio, the number one listener-sponsored network. It's free speech talk radio, totally uncensored, and you're going to notice that tonight as we go into some really sensitive areas, especially in the second hour. But in the meantime, if you like free speech radio, please support Revolution.Radio. Also, please support me, Kevin Barrett, on the web at truthjihad.com and my Substack, where you can subscribe and get early access to the archives of these shows, is kevinbarrett.substack.com. All right, let's get going with tonight's show. Headlined how did I headline this? The 9/11 Truth Legends was how I headlined it at the radio blog, and I said something about the legendary old dudes on my Substack, because, well, we are featuring some real legendary people tonight. Barry Zwicker, first hour guest, was probably the keynote guy. You know, he was the fulcrum of the early 9/11 truth movement. And then Alan Sobrowski in the second hour was the guy who came on my show in 2010 and said, Israel did it. And I've been discussing this with my colleagues at the U.S. Army War College and making it clear that Israel did it. And, of course, that launched a different offshoot of the 9/11 truth movement. Both of these guys are historically important. And, hey, you know, we're all turning into legendary old guys, I guess, or at least old guys. And we're going to be talking about Graham McQueen, who passed away. I guess that's what old guys like us do, is we talk about our friends who passed away. And we're all going to really miss Graham, and so I'll talk about that with Barry Zwicker. I also wanted to mention quickly that my friend, Jim Fetzer, not everybody's friend, but he's definitely my friend. He is in the hospital after a double bypass surgery, so our prayers go out to Jim. He's a really very kind and generous and decent, special human being. Of course, if you've gotten in a big fight with him in the public venue, you might not realize that. But we are praying for Jim. And I heard my friend Rolf just talk to him earlier today. And so he was talking to folks. And God willing, he will be out and about and back on the show. He was on the show last week. And so, man. Anyway, let's get going with the first hour. Barry Zwicker is, well, he was a mainstream journalist in Canada, but a bit of a media critic who actually asked hard questions about the way the mainstream media reported things, and that positioned him to become this really important figure, arguably the most important figure in the early 9/11 truth movement. He directed the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 in Toronto, which was kind of the first big 9/11 conference, as I recall. He published Towers of Deception, one of the best books on 9/11, and he made the Great Conspiracy film and spinoffs, which is at the very top shelf of the films on 9/11. So Barry is a very important, accomplished guy who basically took on this ridiculous big lie with courage and integrity and helped spark this large movement of people who've been questioning it ever since. So I think we have him on the line. Let's find out. Hey, welcome, Barry. Are you there?
I am here. I've been listening quietly as I was ordered to do.
Hey, at least one guy knows how to follow orders, unlike some of my guests. Well, yeah, I honestly didn't even know you were there. You're quiet as a proverbial mouse. Some of these people, they get the call and they just like, hello, 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 hello. And I'm trying to do my monologue and they just keep saying, hello, hello, hello. And it messes with my monologue. But you didn't do that and I appreciate it. So
my
Barry,
pleasure.
Yeah, it's good to reconnect with you. You know, I really love and honor your work, and so you're going to be taking part in a tribute to Graham McQueen, who passed away recently, and that's just happening tomorrow, I think. So, could you tell us about that?
Yes, I'm really happy to see the development of the Lawyers for 9/11 Truth. And this new international body that Ted Walter and others have put together. And because it's easy enough, you know, it's so many years ago, 20 plus years ago, that 9/11 happened. And sometimes you wonder, is it worth it to stick with it? Is it worth it to continue to try to tell the truth about it, to question it, and so forth? And you know that if you look at history, there are so many big lies in history that go on, and they go on for decades. They go on for hundreds of years. For instance, I was born on November the 5th, 1934. So people who can do arithmetic can figure out what year I'm in. But anyway,
I bet people can remember your birthday. They remember the 5th of November.
That's right. There's that little poem. Remember the 5th of November?
You're born on Guy Fawkes Day.
Guy Fawkes Day, otherwise known as Gunpowder Day. But anyway, you know, most people still don't know the truth about that, and it happened in 1605. And
is the Guy Fawkes truth movement still pushing ahead?
I don't know. There have been a couple of books that, you know, spell out what really happened. You know, the official story is that there's 36 barrels of gunpowder in the basement of the British Parliament buildings. In fact, at that time, there was no basement, right, to begin with. Right?
Not only was there no gunpowder, but there was no basement either.
Well, there was gunpowder, actually, but it wasn't in the basement.
Wet gunpowder, yeah.
I beg your pardon?
I think it was wet gunpowder. It wasn't really
primed
to go off.
That is, you are right. It was of inferior quality. So anyway, the official story, the palace version, literally, of the gunpowder plot is still largely believed and has been carried forward. It was something like 200 years until a book came out that really explored the truth about what happened. Mind you, the Guy Fawkes himself and about 12 co-conspirators, they were conspirators. That is true. They were Roman Catholics who were much prejudiced against in the England of that time. But anyway, they were all found and put to death in very short order. So anyway, I don't necessarily expect that the truth will out, as the saying goes. And when it does out, it's just incrementally. It's not like there's a sudden blaze of understanding and the whole population catches on. Just doesn't happen that way. And so obviously it's not happening that way with 9/11, with the truth about it. So, but anyway, I'm very buoyed by the fact that there are still good people, yourself, Kevin, and many others, and there are good organizations that soldier on, if I may use a military phrase. And so we keep the 9/11 Truth Movement alive. And as with the number of people, according to proper public polling, who do not buy the official story of JFK's assassination, that it was a lone gunman. Similarly, there's a substantial fraction of the population that does not accept the official story of 9/11. Or has suspicions about it, questions about it, hypotheses about it. And so that's good. And I said to my wife, and it wasn't fair to her, after I understood what had happened on 9/11, and I am partly proud, but it wasn't just my doing, to say that before noon on the day of 9/11, I caught on that it was a false flag operation. I actually have witnesses who can tell you they were tenants of ours who were visiting in our living room that day as we turned on the TV because we were told by a neighbor that something interesting was going on in New York City. And so at first I believed the official story. I saw the towers come down. And then when the U.S. Air Force did not show up, just did not show up, when there are these alleged terrorists flying all over Hell's Half Acre, I got very suspicious and I said before noon that day, this is a Reichstag fire 2001.
Wow, and you're ahead of a lot of people.
And I've been thanked for that. But the reason that I can't be, all full of myself about that is because of my father. My father was opposed to Hitler early on. My father being a United Church minister in Canada, the United Church minister, United Church has always been a very progressive church. And my father was a political guy, really. Thanks to both his mother and father, they were sort of progressive Presbyterians. And so he was opposed to Hitler, and actually he preached political sermons. And, at the time that Hitler was rising up in the mid-30s, there were magazines like Reader's Digest that were actually pro-Hitler. And they were buying the official story and the mystique of Hitler to some extent.
It was great. When you say the official story, do you mean the Reichstag fire?
There's absolutely the official story about the Reichstag fire. That did not get blown open and that did not get exposed for years and years and years. It was blamed, on a single communist who allegedly went in there and started the fire.
Marius Vandeloup. He was like the Lee Harvey Oswald of 1930s Germany. Lone nut.
Precisely. He was set up and he was rapidly executed. And then, of course, after the Reichstag fire, they collected up all the socialists and communists. They killed a huge number of them and so on. It was a big turning point. Like 9/11, a big turning point started the 9/11 wars. And
Barry, let me just quickly interrupt you here just on behalf of my listeners who sympathize with a kind of revisionist take on World War II, which I do up to a certain extent as well, that argues that this kind of story we've been told, that it was all about Hitler's aggression and that, Hitler was 100% the bad guy and all of the anti-Hitler forces were 100% the good guy, is grossly mistaken. And that, in fact, the blame can be parceled around in very different quantities. Some would go so far as to argue that Hitler's aim was only to reunite the German-speaking lands, and that the reason the war happened was more the result of miscalculations by people like Churchill, or bad calculations, and perhaps rather good strategic calculations from people like Roosevelt.
Well, You know, I have a saying that I repeat endlessly, and that is, everything is more complicated than it at first appears. And that is certainly true of historical events. And I'm much in praise, for instance, of these wonderful books by David Ray Griffin. Specifically, I've read recently The American Trajectory, Divine or Demonic. And so he spells out behind various historical incidents such as Pearl Harbor and of course 9/11 and so forth, that there are complications behind, and it's hard to find anybody who's completely faultless, and it's hard to find anybody who is a total devil, you know, including Hitler, for goodness sakes, because there's already...
You mean even Hitler wasn't really a Hitler? We know Gaddafi wasn't a Hitler, and Saddam wasn't a Hitler, but you're saying Hitler wasn't a Hitler?
I beg your pardon?
I'm actually borrowing a joke from Ron Unz, who just wrote a really good World War II revisionist piece in which he joked that he knew that that Saddam wasn't really a Hitler and that Gaddafi wasn't really a Hitler, but he was very surprised when he read a number of books about World War II and learned that Hitler wasn't a Hitler either.
Oh, okay, I get you. Right. That's good. That's funny, and that's true. That's excellent. And now, David Ray Griffin's final book, published posthumously, is America on the Brink, How U.S. Foreign Policy Led to the War in Ukraine. So if you want to look at something that seems simple, such as Putin is just a tyrant, and he just simply started the war, and it was unjustified, and which is the standard line from the State Department and the Atlantic Magazine and on, not that simple, of course, not that simple, because Russia, with the continued encirclement by NATO of Russia, was and is existentially threatened. And if Ukraine got into or gets into NATO, you know, there will be missile sites, nuclear missile sites, 5 minutes from Moscow. USA would not put up for one damn instant with anything like that kind of encirclement and danger. And so the hypocrisy is a mile high on these things. But I think I've kind of digressed. That's my tendency.
Yeah, let's get back to 9/11 Truth and Graham McQueen, who was another Canadian like yourself, who contributed enormously to this movement about finding out the truth about this crucially important event that happened here in the United States.
Indeed, and that's where we should be. And the fact is, as I've mentioned to you by email and sent you an attachment, I've been asked to be one of three people who leads off the commemoration for Graham tomorrow. It starts at 4 p.m. Eastern and in New York City. And so I, of course, have prepared something to say. I think there's something like a 5-minute limit that we, Ted Walter and Elizabeth Woodworth, are the other two people who have been invited to lead off remarks at the commemoration of Graham's life. And so I have mine, and you have seen it and agree that probably it would be suitable if I was to share this with your listeners right now.
Yeah, please do, Barry. First, let's quickly remind the listeners that Graham was a Buddhist studies scholar, among other things, the founder of a great peace studies program at McMaster, and that he made two enormous contributions to the truth movement. One was investigating the eyewitness testimonies of explosions at the World Trade Center, and the other was writing the best book on the anthrax element of the 9/11 anthrax coup d'etat, and that was called The 2001 Anthrax Deception. And those were two just, you know, you can't, two of the very biggest contributions to the truth movement. And so he was a really important guy, as well as a good guy. And you'll be talking about that.
Very much a good guy, and who actually founded the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and a wonderful friend, a smart person, as you say, a Buddhist. And so I'll just thank you for bringing that up for the listeners, which partly sketches in the kind of person that Graham was, and whose work will live on indefinitely. And so I'll just share what I've actually written out to say tomorrow at the actual memorial for him, if I may.
Go right ahead.
So it goes like this. When I first met Graham, the first thing I learned about him was that I would not learn from him about his remarkable accomplishments. For instance, that he had founded the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University. I have zero recollection that he told me that. Of course, the functioning of my memory, or should I say the low functioning of my memory, is a factor here. But I think that those with superior memories who knew him will tell you how deep was his humility. I don't know when or how I learned that he became a Buddhist, but we did have in common that we were both sons of the manse. In our cases, United Church of Canada manses. And we both grew up in the Canadian Maritimes. I'd become an atheist Christian humanist. So we had in common a non-theistic questioning approach to everything and shared an achingly deep wish for and commitment to the dream of peace, of preventing and ending all wars. We met because we both understood that the official story of 9/11 was a big lie and that this was very important, opening the door to the so-called war on terror and the 9/11 wars. Some of the deepest and most lasting friendships I've been blessed with are based on that common recognition. I was able to tell Graham that in an email just back on March the 16th, and I'll quote from it if I may. "This day reminds me again of the unintended byproduct of the massive deception of 9/11, the finding of fellow spirits such as yourself and those you thank in your acknowledgments, and others who remain close friends and associates still 22 years later. I'd received a link Graham sent me and just three others with an attachment, the Pentagon B movie, Graham's legacy book, or as he put it, quote, yo, my friends, I decided to pull together the 9/11 related articles I'd written over the years, unquote. It includes the brilliant analysis he and Ted Walter produced, based on their tracking down 169 video clips of news coverage from early in the day of 9/11, in which journalists and others reported the demolition explosions in the Twin Towers. But further clips then show this reportage was replaced by carefully planned and executed propaganda from official and planted mouthpieces. So I wrote Graham that, quote, it was not too soon to declare that the Pentagon B movie is a tour de force, a profoundly important work that's compelling, highly informative, and inspirational to those of us tilling the same ground, trying to expose what's beneath the surface of the U.S. empire and its deranged brainchild 9/11. So he and I also had in common that we organized public inquiries into the truths of 9/11, and you mentioned that Kevin, and we both authored books on this. And his 2014 book, The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, as you mentioned, it's a model of superior research and writing. And this also applies, and this is where Gene might bring up one image that I've supplied to him. This also applies to his 2016 book, the October 22, 2014 Ottawa shootings, Why Canadians Need a Public Inquiry. Now, I'm not sure how many people know about his about that event, as a matter of fact, which we can discuss a little bit later, perhaps. But I'm not sure how many people know about his 2022 book entitled Journey to the City of Six Gates. As soon as I found out about it, probably not from him, I purchased it. And trite as it is to say, I could not put it down and read it in one evening. It has earned 5 out of 6 stars on Goodreads. The summary includes this, quote, its heroes, they're a 14-year-old princess and her 12-year-old brother, must discover how to deal with injustice without descending to the level of their violent persecutors. Through contemplative, poetic incantation and robust, uncluttered prose, it weaves into its fabric issues such as the status of women and care for the forests. And that really reflects a lot about Graham, that book. Graham was literally a gentleman. When he said he was angry about the lies of 9/11, he did not shout it. All the more you knew it was true. I don't recall, and again, my memory is an issue, that he ever directed anger at a person or persons he would name. His spirituality was deep and profound. When I last saw him at a meeting last year at a friend's home, along with 5 other friends, he went on longer than usual on the question of some kind of afterlife. I don't mind saying I was spellbound by what he was saying and thinking as he spoke how deeply respectful I was of him. He had stage 4 cancer of the prostate. He was not fooling himself about his mortality. He was exploring it as deeply as he explored everything. And finally, his sense of humor. It was ever present, which made his company additionally pleasant always. And I can sort of hear his voice now as I think of him. So that's my tribute to Graham McQueen that we've learned a little bit about already this evening here.
All right. That's beautiful, Barry. Thank you. Yeah, Graham did have a great sense of humor. And sometimes, you know, it could come out, it could be, you know, perfectly biting. Like when he said that if the anthrax perps who had written on their anthrax letters, death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. If they had wanted to frame Native Americans, they would have written white men in heap big trouble.
Exactly. Yeah. No, great sense of humor, Graham. Absolutely. And that goes a long way in life in general, you know, to have a sense of humor and keep it alive and share it. So that gives you a good feeling thinking about him in that respect.
Yeah, he's the kind of guy I would have loved to have had as an academic colleague. You know, right now, I'm not particularly heartbroken about having been hounded out of the academy and become unemployable in the American and Western academies, just because, frankly, most of what goes on there strikes me as pretty pathetic, certainly in the human sciences anyway. But there are these good people who manage to survive in certain university positions. And, you know, he's one of them. You know, so if I could imagine a good situation teaching in a university, it would be with colleagues like him.
Indeed. And it's not for nothing that most of us remember our college days, to some extent our high school days, and then perhaps especially our college or university days as very important, when we made great friendships that often last a lifetime. And so it's a wonderful thing to have. I you know, a little bit of an offshoot to this. I listen to CBC Radio all the time, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and there are three channels, more than three, but three main ones. And on the morning classical music show, the hosts share bits of wisdom and news. Radio hosts normally do that, right, don't they, between songs and so forth. That's not unusual. But what I heard this morning really interested me. The host said, referred to some study, which I believe was a legitimate study, about happiness. And this involved thousands and thousands of people who were studied in regards to what could make them happy. And the host went on to say that it wasn't money, it wasn't power and prestige that was a common thing with people who are happy. What it was, what it is having 8 minutes, for some reason, 8 minutes is mentioned, 8 minute telephone conversations with their friends, because we're social animals. And to bring it down to that is really, really something. Somehow relates a bit to what you just said, Kevin. I don't think it relates much, but I think
The 8 minutes is interesting. That sounds like sort of an optimal length for a fairly, you know, in-depth YouTube, right? I mean, I put all this stuff on YouTube that goes on and on and on for, you know, an hour or 2 hours or whatever. But apparently most people like to click on really short YouTubes. And so, you know, 8 minutes seems like a pretty short conversation to me. You know, I talk with friends like you, you know, 9/11 Truth friends for an hour here on Friday nights on the live radio show and so on. But with the 8 minute thing, exactly eight, like 7 minutes wouldn't do it, and nine would be too much. And so what's with that? And are you supposed to talk with a particular friend for exactly 8 minutes, like once a week, once a month? And then you should have at least eight friends with whom you talk 8 minutes each for, I mean, what's the rest of it besides the 8 minutes?
I'm actually going to look into this. The host could just give a super abstract rendering of the report, but I'm pretty sure that we could rather quickly find it one way or another. And I mean, there are happiness studies, there are studies of the relative happiness of people in various countries and so forth. I think Denmark usually comes out on top. But anyway, I hadn't heard it before. And it had to do with the kind of friendships that we have with people like Graham McQueen, and why these last and why they're so important and give our lives meaning. And, you know, you wrote a wonderful eulogy for him yourself, Kevin, and you wrote it very soon after Graham passed away. And it's a marvelous tribute to him that you wrote.
Well, thank you, Barry. Yeah, well, I did just Google the 8 minute phone call thing, and there's a New York Times story about it and lots of other stories as well. And it looks like the thrust of it is that 8 minutes is a good length for the phone call that maintains a friendship. So rather than talking to somebody for an hour once or twice a year, you should talk to them for 8 minutes, you know, pretty often. So maybe I need to change my radio show. So instead of an hour-long conversation on Friday nights, I should have lots of eight-minute conversations with lots of people throughout the week and splice them together or something. I don't know if that would work for the radio show.
Well, maybe there's room for a new show called the 8 Minute Show.
There you go. Why is
it 8 minutes?
That's better than better than 3 minutes of hate or whatever that Orwellian thing was. But yeah, eight minutes of truth. Yeah. I think we have a new concept here.
Yeah, eight minutes to a happy life and a meaningful one. But, you know, who knows? We learn things every single day, do we not? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so, well, you know, that maintaining relationships thing is there's probably something to that. And, you know, I probably am not that great at it. You know, I don't really like phone calls. I'm kind of a technophobe. I like to talk to people face to face. And it's always sort of driven me crazy that I can't do that, you know, since I was young and bohemian in San Francisco when I could. But since then, I haven't really been able to. But, yeah, that's an interesting, you know, I do occasionally get on the phone with the second hour guest today, Alan Zabrowski, who is more that way. Like, you know, a lot of people do sort of maintain these telephone type relationships. And he does that. He calls me out of the blue sometimes and he's somebody with views that probably, you know, they're a little different from mine. Certainly they were very challenging to mine when I first met him. You know, he's a pretty hardcore conservative. And if you read his recent article, Barry, it's called Feminine Dystopia. He's basically calling for women to be chased out of many aspects of public life. anyway, you know, meeting the people I meet on these shows who have views that are often whatever, something about those views has gotten them censored from the mainstream. And a lot of those people, of course, have figured out things like 9/11. That's been really interesting because my boundaries have been stretched out. I've, you know, met all of these really smart, interesting people with views that are not allowed into the mainstream. And it's, I think that's a good experience. It makes you think, you know, the mainstream is really doing a bad thing here by preventing these interesting voices from helping stretch the minds of more people.
Indeed. And, you know, there's a friend of mine, actually my oldest friend, his name is Terry O'Connor. And we went to college together from 1955 to 1958, took journalism at Ryerson University in Toronto. And he used a word one time that stuck with me ever since. And he talked about my approach. And he just said, your approach. And I've thought about different people's approaches. And that word, it has a large meaning for me. And for instance, you and Graham have a very similar approach because you are tolerant up to a point, tolerant of very diverse views and views with which you do not agree necessarily, and often you disagree with. You're that way. Graham was that way. I hope I'm that way a bit, but not as much as you guys. And it's what enables you to have such a successful radio program, because you're not ruling people out, because you've got a kind of a sclerotic view of things that has to be reproduced thanks to your program, the way probably Fox News, has a line there that it generally follows and promotes. And so that is so welcome. And Graham, as I mentioned in what I just read, when he was talking about the possibility of an afterlife, and I being scientific inclined, so was Graham scientifically inclined, and I found it hard and find it hard to believe there can be life after this one. But I thought that he was so eloquent, so thoughtful, so probing in going into this subject. And after all, we have things to learn about the universe we can't dream of. You know, there are trillions, not millions, trillions of galaxies. I have only learned this in the last couple of years. I mean, it's you know, mind-boggling, doesn't cover it. And so who is to say, not me, that there could not be life after death, some form of life. And he, I think everybody was spellbound as he talked about it. And time stood still, if you will. This was a very thoughtful person of great intellect and moral force and curiosity, who applies the scientific method and then goes beyond it to some extent. And it was a privilege to be there and hear him talk about this. I imagine we were all changed to some extent that morning.
Well, that's interesting that that Graham was interested in the afterlife and gave such a moving talk about it. That's also a topic that David Ray Griffin, another religious studies professor, was interested in and did research on, actually. And that's how I actually encountered him, was through his work on reincarnation. And he edited a book based on a conference on psi issues, you know, the debate over whether the mind can do all of these things that seem to sort of indicate a transcendence of physical reality. And so, yeah, David and Graham, I think were kind of, had a certain similarity in being really profound, very highly intelligent people who went into religious studies, which took certain courage, right? Because, I mean, the real religion of the elites has been anti-religious or anti-traditionally religious for at least a century now. And then they applied their rigorous intellects to some of these really, deep issues, including that afterlife issue, and did good work on that. And that's another thing that, that's pretty heretical, actually, in the academy now. You don't really want to be taking psi research seriously in the academy if you want to further your career, even though there's a really powerful body of work it's a legitimate discipline. And they don't have to prove that psi exists anymore. They did that decades ago. And yet much of the academy is unaware of this, ignorant of it, wants to remain ignorant, and just reflexively barks and yowls and drools against it. And so those guys had the courage to follow the truth wherever it led, including, through scientific evidence for these kinds of paradigm-busting phenomena. And so Barry, by the way, you mentioned that you kind of come out of an atheist and basically, I think, materialist school of thought. And I'm wondering, has that changed at all, or have you explored any different alternatives to that? There's a great book out by Bernardo Kastrup called Materialism is Baloney. And from a purely philosophical perspective, he shows that the materialist philosophy doesn't cut it, that it's actually much simpler, more straightforward, more elegant, more in line with the basic evidence of our senses every day to embrace idealism rather than materialism. That is, the universe is consciousness. It's not basically matter.
Well, I don't think I've ever followed a materialist line. I don't really trust materialism. I'm not sure what it always means. But one thing I recalled as you were speaking just now, about 1 minute ago, and you said, follow the truth wherever it may lead. And this was a very powerful thing that my father taught me. I remember he was a great, besides being a very good pastor and being a daring political pastor, he almost lost one of his pastorates because, to go back again to Hitler, he was preaching against Hitler from the pulpit back in Port Hood, Nova Scotia in 1933-34, around the time I was born. And numbers of the congregation did not care for it. And Reader's Digest thought Hitler was pretty good.
Yeah, things sure have changed, haven't they, Barry? I mean, you can't imagine somebody facing being thrown out of their pulpit for dissing Hitler today.
No, No, I don't think you could. And so he almost lost. And I wish he'd kept fuller diaries. I have his diaries, but they were 5-year diaries, and you only get 4 or 5 lines per day. And I've read between some of those lines when the board was meeting and threatening to let him go. And so he paid prices for his political religious approach. And so I remember he was great gardener too. And Swan River, Manitoba, northern Manitoba, he actually had 3 gardens. There was this ample garden behind the manse. And then there was a railroad man across the lane who was away a lot. And my father agreed to take care of his garden. And then he had another garden on the outskirts of town. And my mother, too, was a gardener and grew all sorts of flowers. So I remember being in the back garden with him. It was more than once had happened. And I was perhaps 14 or 15. And I had to tell him that I couldn't believe in God anymore. And here I am, a preacher's kid, right? And he wasn't shocked. And he said, "Son, you have to follow the truth wherever it may lead." Now, I know that's a cliche, but he told me that when I was around that age, my pastor father. He gave me permission, in other words, to be at least agnostic and did not feel threatened by it, and allowed me to try to find my own mental and spiritual way. And so he was a wonderful mentor. And he was the biggest influence in my life, and remains so, because he also asked me at one point if I had felt the call. And, you know, that's terminology in church circles, whether you have felt the call to be a clergyman, to go into the ministry. And I had to tell him no. I had not felt the call, and he completely accepted that. He wasn't going to be disappointed or whatever. He just asked, and I answered. So he was certainly a model and a mentor, so that all resonates with some things you've just said, and with the approach of Graham and the approach of David Ray Griffin, and. These are people to look up to. These are people to learn from. And I hope I have. And I hope that I've been some kind of a model for, I know I have, for my son. I'm almost embarrassed when he tells me how he looks up to me, despite all my flaws. So these are very important human connections, findings, beliefs, and ways of being. I'm glad the conversation has turned this way.
Yes. Well, Barry, you know what you did was very courageous in that you had a journalism career and you were writing for mainstream papers. And when you saw something wrong with the official story of 9/11, you obviously could see as things developed that the journalism world wasn't eager to embrace the information that you were going to put out there. And yet you just went ahead and did it and faced marginalized.
I have interrupted you. You haven't got the chronology right there. I was in the mainstream media, and then I left to freelance. And that was around 1970. It's a long time ago now, way before 9/11. So I was not in mainstream journalism at the time of 9/11 whatsoever.
Well, you were doing media criticism, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I was a long time on air commentator for Vision TV. Actually, the first multi spiritual television, national television channel in the world, Vision TV. Vision TV welcomed all religions, and including no religion people, including atheists and agnostics. And it remains still a pretty good channel, but it's just a shadow of what it used to be. And I joined it in September 1988 at its launch, and I was there for 13 happy years. I had my own program after a while. And it was while I was at Vision that 9/11 happened. And that is when I realized, as I've already mentioned here, that 9/11, the official story, was completely a lie. And so I knew that, and I was wondering what to do about it. And then it occurred to me, hey, I've got my own television program. Why don't I do something about it on my own television program? And I actually had to. It wasn't a matter of clearing it. We had a very collegial production crew there of about a dozen people. And so I got up the nerve. I did speak to my video editor, Barry Silverthorne. We're still great friends. And I told him just a couple of days. I think 9/11 was a Tuesday. And I believe we had Friday afternoon meetings. And so very soon after 9/11, I said to Barry, you know, you may think I'm crazy, but I've got real questions about what really happened on 9/11. He said, me too. And so I found out there were several others there at that point who did. But then I had to raise it in order to do any television programming on it. I had to raise it at the production meeting. And it took me a while. I thought, how am I going to do it? How am I going to introduce this and persuade the others, enough of the others, that I should tackle the truth about 9/11 in my commentaries? And so week after week went by, and I couldn't figure out how to approach it. And then one day I just blurted it out. I said, I don't believe the official story of 9/11. And I'd like to do something about it in my program called Mediafile. And so interestingly, one of the other producers, when it came to the question of, you know, why didn't the U.S. Air Force take off and intercept those alleged terrorists who had captured these planes and flying them all over Hell's Half Acre? And she said, well, the reason they didn't take off, they hadn't had their morning coffee. You know? I mean, it was the rationalizing mind. You know, we've all seen the rationalizing mind. It's that's way the human mind will make up stuff right on the spot.
Right. Well, they fixed that, Barry, by putting these coffee machines that spurt out a cup of coffee in less than half a second now at all the air bases. So now if there's an attack on America, fighter jets will get off the ground in a timely fashion.
That's modern technology to the rescue. Yeah. But anyway, then so what I did was it ended up I produced seven commentaries, 7 weeks. They were weekly. I produced a commentary for 7 weeks about 9/11. And it made me the first person on national television in the world. I've tried to check it out. I tried to check it out quite a few times. I haven't been able to find contrary evidence that I was the first television host in the world to question the official story of 9/11 on national television.
I'm pretty sure you were.
I think so. But again, you know, it goes back to my father saying, follow the truth wherever it may lead, and which you mentioned, you actually stated that, quoted that in this very program 5 minutes ago, and it would be the kind of thing that Graham believed and David Ray Griffin believes in too, and it's a very important standard. It really is, because it, you know, you have to have a little bit of courage if you're really going to follow that, and you're going to have to embarrass yourself probably and some people. You may lose status, you may lose income, God knows, but people lose their lives over their beliefs. So to just lose something short of your life isn't that much of a sacrifice. And actually, I've been lucky. I've never paid much of a penalty. I know that there were opportunities that didn't come my way, and I could imagine what could feed into that fact. But I've never been ambitious anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
The big move I made was to leave conventional journalism. I was with the Toronto Star. First, I was with the Globe and Mail, Canada's national newspaper, for 8.5 years. And then the Toronto Star invited me, and by doubling my salary and giving me more freedom than I even had at the Globe, I went over to the Star. But and the managing editor, I left then in a year. I could see by then I had become enough of a media critic to see that I didn't want to stay in conventional journalism. And so it was like jumping off a cliff to go freelancing, because I've never been prolific and I didn't make much money. And it wasn't fair to my wife, because she might not have rather gone back to work as she did. You know, we had small kids, and I really wasn't contributing to the family larder that well. I worked hard as a freelancer, but I never made anything close.
You know, I kind of relate to that, Barry, having left the Academy and been a freelancer ever since. But I think we hit the end of the hour. I hear the background music in the background where it's supposed to be. So, but Barry.
Oh, my God. There we go. Yeah.
Great to catch up with you.
Yes. But I imagine you'd agree. And I was about to say, and this is kind of getting to be my way of conclusion, that the freedom that we get when we're freelancing, when we're free of an institution, is very, very important.
Okay. Well, freedom ain't free, and that's why you need to contribute to Revolution.Radio and Kevin Barrett's Substack.com. All right. Thanks, folks, and thank you, Barry. God bless, and see you next time.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crip Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's Ivan Baker. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
All right, thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of Truth Jihad Radio. Kevin Barrett here at truthjihad.com and kevinbarrett.substack.com, where you can subscribe to get early access to the archives of these shows. Please do help keep us on the air. You can help out revolution.radio, and you can help me out by going to my Substack and subscribing. Again, you'll get early access and free downloads. Okay, let's get going with the second half of tonight's special show on the two 9/11 truth legends. We just talked to Barry Zwicker during the first hour. He was kind of the original 9/11 truther. Like he said, he woke up instantly the morning it happened. By noon, he knew it was a false flag. And he organized a whole lot of stuff early on. Well, the next decade of the 9/11 truth movement was heavily influenced by my second hour guest, Alan Zabrowski, the former head of strategic studies at the U.S. Army War College, who came on my radio show in spring 2010 and declared that Israel or Mossad did 9/11, period. Now, that eloquent show went all over the place, and pretty soon he was invited to Press TV and all sorts of other shows to say the same thing, and naturally, he managed to stir up a real hornet's nest. And for some reason, that didn't teach him a lesson, and so he's still stirring up hornet's nests. He hasn't stopped. And now he's stirred up one of the biggest ones yet with his article that came out just, was it yesterday or day before yesterday, called the most, what's it called, Feminine Dystopia, From Mystique to Monster. And in it, he gives a rundown of the history of feminism and finishes by arguing that women ought to be kept out of a number of areas of public life, including politics, law, higher education, the armed forces, police, and especially the government at any level. So I think a lot of used tampons are probably flying towards his head even as we speak. Hey, Alan, how's it going?
Oh, Kevin, first of all, I think you need to coordinate your artwork. This is several people have mentioned this. The picture you have on the screen that I see right now, and that I assume that your listeners will see, is me at close to my present age. The one we used to advertise the show looks like my son. It was like 30 years ago. I wish I were 30 years younger, but I'm not. It's a nice idea, but you know, I'll send you the new artwork to update it. Second, I've got a serious question. What is this legendary old dude crap for the three of us? For Barry, Mike Jones, and me.
Well, what I just realized was that you and Barry and Mike, the three guys I'm talking with on my broadcast this weekend, all three of you are older than me, and you're all historically significant. And so I said, how can I frame this in a way that's kind of punchy and engaging? And so that's where I came up with the old dudes and the legends and all that sort of stuff.
I don't disagree with the old dude part, at least for myself. I'll leave Barry and Mike to make their own judgment on it. But, you know, I'm not a spring chicken. I'm not a summer rooster, but you aren't either.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to subtly work myself in there by, you know, I sent out that thing at my Substack, and I had my wild and crazy Islamic sermon at the end. And so I was trying to be a troublemaking old dude, too, although I don't think I was able to raise as much hell as you were with this latest article.
I've gotten a fair number of emails and text messages and responses. Surprisingly, a very large number of the women who have bothered responding have been very supportive of it. A lot of them, well, I'm not going to say a lot of them because I don't know what percentage we're talking about. But I remember the wife of one of the people I met up in Michigan when I was there in late April, early May for that invited talk in Lansing. Well, just East Lansing, actually, Jensen Okemos. You know, remarked after I made a similar comment because I was finishing some of my preparatory work for this article then, you know, that if we could get a more stable society, she'd tear up her voting card and throw it away happily. Think there's more than a little bit of that out there. There's an interesting poem I'll start with at this point. Rudyard Kipling is one of my favorite poets, probably to no one's surprise. And he has a phrase in it: women and horses and power and war are four things greater. Since none know the temper of women and horses, my son, let us talk of power and war. And that's about it.
That's pretty good.
It is. It really is good. Actually, there was, and I saw a comment on the article on the UNCE review about an hour ago, and I just had a brief time to check the reference. And one of the people commenting raised by a book by a fellow named Unwin. He was a professor at Oxford University in the very early part of the 20th century. And he published a book in 1934, having examined cultures and civilizations around the world over a period of thousands of years. And what he, and I was unaware of this book, by the way, when I wrote the article, or I would have cited it. And he found that in every single instance where women acquired anything close to equal rights and sexual freedom, within three generations max, the societies collapsed.
Yeah, I saw that reference too. I haven't read Unwin, but it sounds interesting.
It's intriguing because, you know, within our, I'm not going to say our memory, but within our relatively recent history, we know that happened in Weimar Germany. All the bad things that the woke world have done to America and to the West, they did in Weimar Germany. There was a measure of desexualization, I guess you would say, or sexual freedom under Lenin that turned out to be catastrophic, and probably one of the more sensible things that Stalin, who you know is not one of my favorite guys, did was to reverse it. We had a slight taste of it in the 1960s, and it had very mixed results. And, of course, the Cultural Revolution in China in the 1960s, led by Madame Mao, damn near broke the society. Now, these are pretty different countries. You know, Leninist Soviet Union, Weimar Germany, post-World War I Empire, and Maoist China. These are fairly different, even in our current and ourselves now, and all four of them going the same way. And it's not a matter of a lack of intellectual capability. I don't know what your experience was in high school and college, but the girls in high school, the women in college, were always scoring higher than the guys.
Yeah. They're better in high school and at least as good in college, in undergraduate. When you get to grad school, though, you do start to find a little bit of a male edge.
You do. You definitely do. And I think I was going to say, particularly in math and the sciences, except that for some odd reason, you know, I do a lot of computer work. Math and the sciences, I am very, very bad. My father was very, very good, and I am very, very bad in that. So I'm not going to criticize anyone for not being good in math and the sciences. But it's really very, very intriguing. And this, to think of this phenomenon. Now, it's not surprising where physical matters came into it. There was a hearing, and I can't remember if it was in the House or the Senate. I think it was in the Senate. And a black woman was testifying in favor of allowing trans women, you know, biological males, to compete against biological females. She said the idea that a man, that just being a man would allow them an edge over a woman is impossible to think of. And she mentioned one of the two Williams girls, sisters, you know, Venus and Serena, you know, phenomenal tennis players, champions. And one of the women there who was testifying against them, and I believe she had been an NCAA swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania. I think it was the University of Pennsylvania. Might have been the University of Kentucky because they were both there. And I don't know women's swimming, NCAA swimming. She said Venus and Serena Williams were both beaten by a man who ranked something like 203 in men's tennis. You know, not even in the top 10. I mean, there's no competition. There really isn't. And in any endeavor where physical strength and endurance are required, the only way that you get enough women in it to stop being, you know, the odd one out, you know, because there are occasional exceptions to anything, is to change the standards. And that's happened everywhere. It's happened in fire departments. It's happened in police departments. It's happened at the service academies. It's happened in the armed services, including the Marine Corps. They had a point where they wanted to get women in the ground combat arms. I mentioned that in the article. And they changed the standards. They allowed a woman to continually repeat the infantry officer's course as standards were, quote unquote, adjusted. Things were just dropped. They were made optional. They were made pass fail. They weren't counted until finally she managed to pass. No man was allowed to do that. No man was ever allowed to repeat it that many times.
Right, right. Alan, so you're obviously right about these areas that require that kind of physical strength and endurance. But how does that relate to keeping women out of politics, law, education, the armed forces, and the government? None of those areas require physical strength.
Well, it does the armed services. But
armed services.
I think what has happened in the other case, and I don't really know why it has happened. All I can do is see the what, and if the what is bad enough, you know you don't want to do it anymore. I think a large part of it is that the most radical feminists, the cultural Marxists, who really do want to destroy the nuclear family, who really do want to break Western civilization, because then on the ruins of it, they expect to build their own civilization, that these people hijacked not just the feminist movement, but the institutions up front, particularly education, where people are basically civilized or encultured and acquire their basic view of life. You know, one of the things that has nothing to do with modern history, but illustrates this, during the over the first three centuries of the Common Era, the Christian Era, whichever you want to do it, 3 to 4 centuries, the dominant religion of the Roman legions and of a good part of the Romans who were running the empire was Mithraism, which has an awful lot of similarity to Christianity. You know, a savior born in a manger, became a teacher, executed, rose to heaven, etc. But it differed from Christianity in that Mithraism was only for men and specifically for soldiers, particularly for soldiers, not specifically for soldiers, but particularly for soldiers. Christianity gave right of access in the early years, early centuries, to women and slaves. Women and slaves were the ones who educated the children. And that's why Christianity won more than anything else over Mithraism in the Roman Empire. Whoever educates the children will shape the future.
Catholic Church says? Didn't the Catholic Church say, give me a 3-year-old and I'll make him a Catholic for life?
I have no idea. I'm not a Catholic. But I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. I mean, they learned from this. They were the ones who did the teaching, who did the breaking in the Roman Empire. And it's absolutely true. You know, if you get control of that, that's what happens. And I think it's really fascinating that the left-leaning academic community probably was instrumental in shaping the views of so many of these people into a more radical mode. And, you know, of course, that extended into the other areas. It extended into law, so you find radical judges and radical prosecutors. You extended into the corporate world, which is probably the last place you'd expect to find leftist views, you know, in a capitalist corporations, but you do. BlackRock and Vantage are big on this, are big on the woke world, very big on it. You know, Procter & Gamble and Bud Light and the rest of it were not exceptions. They were the rule. It's hard to find corporations or businesses with which to do anything that aren't. And the women dominated are the more radical ones. A lot of these are male-dominated. A lot of these corporations are male-dominated. Vantage, for example. But the women have tended to be more radical, and I'm not sure why that happened, but it did. And that's the effect. And I think that we have to take a hard look at reality. And like I said, painful though it is, I'm still trying to work out some way some filter to allow, you know, some of the really good women that you and I both know, smart, tough, good people, into these professions, into these areas, without opening the floodgates to let the mass through, because the mass is very bad and very destructive, and that's the end of the game.
Yeah, Ellen, I guess first I would say that I don't know if we can really blame the women any more than the men for the way the academy has gone radical and woke, because I remember when this was all getting started, when I started in college in the mid-70s to late-70s, and at that time, there were definitely more male professors than female ones who were, well, they were all sort of getting off onto these trendy types of radical approaches. You know, there were the more sensible sort of materialist Marxist positions interested in redistributing the wealth. And I still think a lot of those have a certain amount of accuracy to those diagnoses. But then there were all these bizarre sorts of spin-offs with feminism and upholding the outcasts like the homosexuals and so on, and making them the new sort of the new deities and so on. That kind of process happened. I didn't really see women pushing that much more than men, as I recall. I studied with one of the world's greatest feminists, Hélène Cixous, in Paris for a year. I took her seminar. And she actually, I don't know what she's doing now, or even if she's still around, but she and the most of the other French feminists had no use for the crazy American feminists who tried to deny the reality of gender. These French feminists all insisted that women were different. Vive la différence. But anyway, sum total of my experience has been that I just don't know if it's really the fault of the women, although I do think that you're onto something in terms of the younger women nowadays are really the carriers of this disease. But then second point and more important point is that, well, what's the solution to this? I have a solution for you. It's real simple, and it's the way it just do what the Muslims do, which is separate the genders. So this was kind of surprising to me when I first got into Islam. You go to a party, and there's one room where all the men eat together. There's a totally separate room where all the women eat and the small children. And then once the boys get to be like, you know, 8 or 10 or something, they'll go and eat with the men. And everything is like that. And so there are two totally different spheres for men and women. There's a men's world, which includes the cafes and to a large extent the mosques, or at least the men's part of the mosques, and then the smaller parts of the mosques, and then the female bathhouses, maybe in Morocco, for example, the saint shrines in the rural areas, and then the home, the inner sanctum of the home. These are the female spaces. And yes, the sex is mixed, but only in, you know, when you're really intimate with a family, for example, they'll invite you into the sort of central part of their house and you just hang out with the women who will have their headscarves off and stuff. And that shows you're really good friends with them. But in general, in normal social interaction, the men hang with the men, the women hang with the women. And if you do that systematically, what happens is that the vast majority of women are really much, much, much happier hanging with the women and becoming real women and being focused on, you know, husband and children and taking care of their house and networking with other women to really run the world, which is what they do in these cultures. And they run the world through their influence on their husbands and their sons and so on and deciding who marries who. And it's a really very happy way of life. And then the relatively small number of women who really have something to contribute to the men's world, such as the scholars, for example, or, you know, in some cases, maybe some stateswomen, who knows, scientists, whatever. There are adventurers. There are women who have something to contribute to the men's world, but they're not going to do it unless they're really motivated to do it. And so the special ones will self-select, and they will be the ones who can move out of the women's world and do something in the men's world. And they still won't get invited, you know, to most of the, you know, a lot of the men's areas, but they will be able to do their thing. And so you'll have great women scholars and whatever, merchants and things like that. It works really well. And so I think that's what we need to do. We need to separate the genders, stop mixing so much.
Well, you know, when you were talking about that, I was reminded of a scene in a movie, The Last Samurai. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's really, really intriguing. It's mid to late 19th century Japan. And I won't bore you with the details on it, but there was an aspect of it which I checked with a friend of mine, a Japanese guy, I mean, from Japan. He came to the United States, I guess, 20 years ago. He's still teaching. I'm not going to mention his name because the same feminists who might hunt me down might hunt him down.
you don't care if they hunt you down. You just don't want his blood.
Listen, at 81, come on. You know, my attack cat will guard me. That'll take care of it, like the cat you have on your shoulder in the picture. But there's a scene in it where a young man and a young woman are talking, brother and sister. And the problem is what they do with this foreigner, this American who's recovering in their midst. And the brother is the village chief, and he says to her, "This is my village." And she stares back at him, "This is my house." You know, his authority covered the area between the houses. But in the house, he didn't have authority. He didn't rule. That was really intriguing. And he said, yeah, and he said in 19th century Japan, that was correct. He said that would have been, and 19th century and before, very traditional in Japan, that there were two spheres of power, two worlds, and the worlds overlapped, but not very much. And that there were very clear areas where the two were very powerful. But I want to get to your first point, because that's really the critical one, I think, about affecting. If you don't, we don't understand the process by which something did happen, whether it's good or bad, we can't disrupt it if it's bad or replicate it if it's good. You know, very simple. My experience was the same as yours. Let me rephrase that. My experience in the 1970s in graduate school in Michigan, and overseas when at British, French, and German universities, was the same as yours in graduate school and in Europe. Michigan was a very radical university, you know, the mother church of the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, which were probably the most misnamed terrorist group around in the United States at that time. Most of them were men. There were very few women professors in any of the departments, at least in social sciences. In political science and history, where I did most of my work, just a couple of women in each department. The most radical ones were there. But the effect and where the gender of the teachers and their radicalism seemed to coincide came out of the schools of education. And I only learned about this indirectly later, because I had nothing to do with the school of education. You know, it's the that old saw, those who can do, those who can't teach, those who can't teach, teach teachers. And there was something like that. But in this case, that wasn't true. They had something to teach. And was when this Marx doctrine, the cultural Marxism, began permeating out into the primary and secondary schools and into the teachers' unions, that you have the radicalization really begin. And those are the ones right now that are dominated by women and homosexual males at every level, the school boards, the schools, the school administrations, you know, not uniquely, but dominated. There's a difference on that. The National Education Association, which is the larger teachers union, has about 14,000 school districts in the country, is run by a black woman who's as close to a cultural Marxist, pushing the critical race theory line that I've seen and heard. The American Federation of Teachers is headed by another cultural Marxist, a Jewish woman, who's just been appointed as an advisory board to the Department of Homeland Security. You know, well, how about pouring gasoline on an open fire?
Well, yeah, that's me. You know, the white male nationally, you know, the white males are the new terrorists.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, you and I are clearly terrorists. You're not. Sorry. You may have converted, but you haven't converted enough to change. Sorry, you're still on the target list.
Yeah, I can't seem to get off. First they come for the Muslims. I'm Muslim, and then they give that up and they go after the white males, and I'm stuck being a white male.
Yeah, well, they're going to go after one more, people who have facial hair.
Uh-oh. Well,
we're stuck. You know, we're stuck in the trouble on that. But I think that's what's happened, and I cannot believe this has permeated otherwise conservative states, I mean, like Idaho, Montana, the Dakotas, school boards, teachers are pushing the same line as they are in San Francisco and New York City. You've got conservative governors, you've got conservative legislatures, but the Democrats in the legislatures are pushing the same line as the Democrats in California, New York, Illinois, Michigan. The schools, for all practical purposes, are doing the same thing. They are pushing critical race theory. They are pushing this gender goulash garbage. They are pushing gender transition, genital mutilation for children. It's the women and the homosexual males who are pushing it, and it's the mothers who are cheering it on, the young mothers.
And how come the men don't have the cojones to do something about it?
Good question, Adam. I mentioned that what struck me most forcefully was the I don't know if it was the feminization or the emasculation, whatever you want to do it, of a large number of men. Not all of them, and not all of the women are radical, but the majority of both. I have read in several places that testosterone levels in men have, in white males in Europe and America, and I guess you'd add Canada, Australia, New Zealand to that, have dropped over 50% in the last 30 years, 20 to 30 years. I'm not enough of a scientist to judge it, I can't tell you. But certainly on the basis of behavior, I would estimate it. Supposedly there's increased levels of estrogen in many additives. Again, I'm not a scientist, I can't confirm it, but if you look at it's the sort of thing, you look at what you see and what is happening, it suggests that something is there. And then, of course, the educational system, to a degree that I don't think any of us realized, began somewhere in the 80s and 90s, probably in the 90s, pushing very subtly this anti-male, anti-white male, pro-black, slightly pro-brown position. Asians get basically ignored. They're victims, but I think they're probably considered honorary whites by the people pushing this agenda because they score better than whites and they do better than whites in most areas. It's very tough to beat people who are doing better than you. And as a result, I just thought about something like this a few weeks ago. It's almost as if they were biding their time. And as long as the Soviet Union and the communist governments in Eastern Europe were there and were viable states and were applying pressure, they could hold to the dictum that the revolution, quote unquote, would succeed. It might take longer than planned, but the West would collapse of its own internal contradictions, and the victory of socialism, i.e. communism, would be assured. But when the Soviet Union imploded and communist governments fell throughout Eastern Europe, and communist states like Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia ceased to exist and imploded themselves, it's almost as if there was a plan B. Well, the revolution from outside isn't succeeding. I guess we have to try plan B. And the groundwork had already been laid for it. And so, I'd really like to have someone look at that very carefully. Someone who's younger and can take a fresh look at it. I have too many memories and attitudes that have been shaped by the Cold War and the decades, growing up in that and all the rest of it. I'm not sure I could look at it objectively.
Well, here, let me be that young person, Alan. I'm a little younger than you. I haven't cashed in my Social Security yet, although I am eligible.
I think that you ought to consider it, at least if you can get paid in rubles.
Yeah, well, I'm working on all of that. But meanwhile, in terms of pushing back here, I think your theory that it's a communist plot, which is very common, and we see this all over the place in the alternative sort of conservative-leaning media, I think that's just wrong. I think that there may be strands and threads of cultural Marxism. Yeah, sure. But it looks to me like it's really the opposite. It looks to me like it's a capitalist plot. It looks to me like what we have is a turbocharged elite that has been getting more and more rapacious. Now, the elite in America is a plutocracy. It's ruled by the wealthy, and your power or potential power corresponds very closely with your net worth. And, of course, your net worth to people who have a high net worth. So that's how the country is ruled. And it's gotten vastly more unequal during our lifetimes. And, when we were born, I was born in 1959. At that time, unskilled manual workers made enough to support their families without their wives even working. And their share of the national pie has stagnated or declined while the higher you go up the wealth ladder, the more of the pie that they've gotten hold of. And so this massive explosion of inequality due to unfettered capitalism, that is, capitalism was fettered under Roosevelt all the way through under Eisenhower. Under Eisenhower, the top marginal tax rate was 90%, and that kicked in pretty early. And guess what? The rich people didn't really mind it because they remembered what happened when they didn't slow down this, what Peter Turchin calls the wealth pump, which is this inevitable way of transferring resources from the average people to the rich elite that rules. Every society is ruled by the elite. The only difference is some societies have a rapacious elite that just grabs everything and destroys their society like ours has. And the others are those that have people like Roosevelt and so on who realize they need to share a little bit so that they get a win-win. And so what we have is capitalism has been unleashed in all of its most extremist craziness since the 1980s. And at the same time, the so-called cultural Marxism, which is really cultural capitalism, has come in and it's been used to neuter the left, to lobotomize the left, to take the left was always the side of the political spectrum that said, hey, let's, write the rules of the game in such a way as to favor ordinary people a little bit. And now the left has been turned into a gang of raging lunatics. And all of this gender nonsense is totally identified with the elite. It's only elitists and wannabe elitists who actually believe it. Ordinary people don't. And that's for the very obvious and very good reason that it is in the interest of the elite. The more money and power you have, the better off you are if your society is poisoned by gender madness, at least, because that's going to help you pump more and more wealth into your own coffers until the whole thing burns down and explodes. So I think this whole Marxism thing is completely misguided. And Fidel Castro put the gays in jail, as did almost all the other communists back when they were really communists. Now, Alan, what's happened is this country has been taken over by capitalists. And the communists actually might be part of the solution if we had any left.
Well, it was ironic that I sent a meme to somebody who had asked about Che Guevara, and it was someone talking about being gay or something like that. And you have Che saying in the next picture, take this idiot out and shoot him. This is one of those interesting situations, Kevin. I think we're both partially correct, and we're both haven't stated one of the points, at least you haven't stated one of the points that I did in my article, is that the people pushing this is not just a matter of being rich and wealthy. Of course, the wealthy have always ruled. Doesn't matter what society you're talking about. Sometimes they do it overtly, sometimes they do it covertly, but they rule. That I think it was like 53% of the wealthiest people in America are Jewish. In 2020 election, the 10 largest donors to the Democrats, the 8 largest donors to the Republicans were all Jewish billionaires. So if it's capitalism, it's Jewish capitalism, it's Zionism and capitalism combined on the one side. And of course, Jews were not incidental to Marxism and Marxist spinoffs in Europe as well as in the United States. In fact, for that much throughout the Western world. But what you're describing about the accumulation of wealth around a group, a smaller group, increasingly small group, and then the increasing impoverishment of the rest of it is precisely what happened in one of the most non-capitalist empires around, the Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire. You've described precisely what happened in the 3rd and 4th centuries AD in the West. Exactly that. A relative handful of people amassing control of most of the land, most of the production, massive latifundia with thousands of slaves working the fields, most of the people being relatively impoverished on the dole, that the bread and circuses bit being lined, increasingly unwilling to serve in the armed services, which recruited increasingly barbarians who weren't citizens and even pretend to be citizens, relocated tribes, brought migrants in to settle them along the frontiers. so the men could serve in the Roman armed forces. Not a capitalist society. They still collapsed. So it may simply be the mechanism by which societies die, but it's pretty clear in this case that while the elite, however we choose to define the elite, whether it be a capitalist elite, a Marxist-Leninist elite, a Marxist-capitalist elite, a Jewish-Zionist elite, a Jewish-capitalist elite, a Jewish-Marxist elite, we can take whatever combination we want, because there's a nice set of Venn diagrams we could draw that would cause these to overlap, that a very large number of people do act as if they believe. You know, if large numbers of mothers think that aborting their children is the highest virtue of a mother, you got to wonder about what's happened to their mental state, or their indoctrination, or both. If you have young mothers who actually have given birth to their children, you look like a boy, but I want a girl. I'm going to have a girl. Bring on the surgery. And you have an entire political party, the Democrat political party, not only asserting this, but having espoused women's rights much more than the Republicans, discard women entirely in order to support ideal. It has to be ideological. It's not, they're certainly not for votes. A handful of demented biological males who see themselves as women, or really ambitious biological males. The 6'4" man who swam for the University of Pennsylvania women's team, he ranked, over 400 in men's swimmers. You know, he wouldn't even get close to any swimming pool where people were competing. He broke the records as a woman. And the Democrat Party applauds this. The administrations of the Ivy League universities applaud this and punish anyone who refuses to go along with this. This isn't for money. They've got their money. They're doing it for more than money. The money is there. The money incentive is there. I'm not denying that. How can one deny it? It's real. But there's something else going here, because much of what they're doing doesn't bring them money, doesn't enrich them further. It does have another dimension, and it is absolutely, undeniably, irrefutably evil. And yeah, I'm not saying that in a spiritual or religious sense. I'm saying that in a moral and an ethical sense. It is flat ass evil, and needs to be understood that.
Oh, I agree. It's evil, Ellen. But in terms of it not bringing the money, I don't know. I see it as a sort of war of ideas against the working class, against ordinary people. That is, if the elites can impose this crazy ideology on ordinary people who resist it, of course, all normal, ordinary people are kind of rolling their eyeballs at this at best, and in some cases actually resisting it. But if the elite just crushes them with this and forces them to go along with it, it wins. It's got them under control. You know, I was actually
that much, Kevin, there isn't that much of them. Look at our labor force. Look at the distribution of our labor force in the United States right now. I just saw a demographic 2 days ago. There are 11 states, including California and the one I live in, Mississippi, where there are more people on welfare than are working. And the working class is crushed. It's already done. If you want to say that's the goal, well, it's been accomplished long ago. That 11 states where more people are on welfare than are working. And that's legally. That's not counting the migrants, which now we're talking, God, the number's anywhere from 10 to 18 million. Most of them in the last 2.5 years. You got 300,000 to 400,000 a month coming through. You have Mexican and African migrants coming into New England from Canada. How the hell are they getting there? What are they doing when they get here? Will they get a free ride when they get here?
That's totally for in the benefit of the elites. Not, the elites make Kevin, more money. They drive wages down.
Kevin, and it's not.
They get free nannies.
It's not merely money. It's power. Power.
Well, power.
Money is one of the components of power, but power and control are the goal. That is the absolute goal. Otherwise, they wouldn't need the rest of this.
Right, but politically, the conflict about immigration has always been the capitalists, the people who rule by their possession of capital, which means money, versus labor. Labor wants to shut the borders. Capital wants to open them. It's like really simple. And so whatever bullshit they're coming up with to justify opening the borders, oh, we've got to save these poor people and be humanitarian and love all the brown and purple people or whatever their color is, that's all nonsense. Strip the whole thing down, and what it is normal working people are better off without immigration because they'll get higher wages. Capitalists are better off with immigration because they'll pay lower wages. It's really that
simple. Which, of course, is why the AFL-CIO and the NEA and the AFT, the unions, the leadership of the unions themselves and the people who keep them in the leadership of the unions in power are supporting the Biden policy on immigration.
Because they're part of the elite too. They're conspiring against the people they supposedly represent.
Well, I think, Kevin, you finally managed to out-conspiracy me.
I don't know if it's that hard.
I see this. You know, I understand the role of money. I wish I had more of it, frankly. It would be a much nicer world. I could certainly use one of the lifeboats on one of these yachts and probably sell the lifeboat and live in luxury for the rest of my life. But I see this as really undertaking, because this is what's happening. You know, the societies where the migrants are being brought in are being racially and culturally transformed. And they will ultimately become third world countries. You import the third world, you become the third world. And this may help facilitate control and the extraction of more wealth for the handful of people on top. But the transformation is still taking place. If I were to look at the Soros profit and loss statement, I actually see someone like George Soros and his sons, well, his older son now who's taken over the business, probably fronting for a lot of other Democrat or left-leaning billionaires, Jewish, many of them Jewish perhaps, because he can't possibly be making money on all of the global endeavors attributed to him. He may be making other things. He may be making money for other things. He may be receiving money and favors for the things he's doing. But as an individual, all roads lead to Soros doesn't make any sense.
Well, Alan, don't you think, though, that when Soros talks about open societies, he founds the Open Society Institute, and he spends billions of dollars to open up societies all over the world. What he's really doing is opening them up to the depredations of people like George Soros.
But to do that, he has to undertake, he and his associates have to undertake the racial and cultural transformation of them. Because the traditional white-dominated European and American societies are very tough nuts to crack. Third world is easy. Look at South Africa today. God help it. I saw that country in the 80s, and now I look at it today, and you've got a good idea of what happens, what is happening to Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. It's happening to all of them, with the exception of Russia and a few Eastern former communist countries in Eastern Europe and in the Balkans. It's happening to all of them. Mm-hmm. I also, for some odd reason, you know, I'm surprised that George Soros and his colleagues don't tell Israel to open up its borders.
I wonder why that would be.
have you noticed that strange exception?
Yeah, there's no big Open Society Institute in Israel opening up those borders.
There really isn't. Well, why don't you go over and start one when you're in Morocco?
Maybe I'll write a grant proposal and give it to Soros and his Open Society Foundation to give me $1 billion so I can go to occupied Palestine and help Hamas open up those borders.
Don't even talk about that. Write to Netanyahu's son, one of his sons is in the IDF. Or write to Netanyahu himself. He's back in prime minister. Write to him and say that you think it's important for Israel to be a beacon for the rest of the world and show that open borders can work and to open up its borders.
You know, that sounds like something that RFK Jr. might do.
It sounds like something that would get you and me both knocked off by Mossad chicks, me in Mississippi, you in Morocco, actually.
Yeah. No, just, you know, phrasing, you know, making nice noises about wonderful things in Israel that have nothing to do with any possible reality. That is something RFK Jr. has been doing lately. But
yeah, of course he has. But, you know, it's just. Yeah. Well, he also understands what happened to his father and his uncle.
Yeah, but does he have Stockholm syndrome or what? Is he humoring? I was thinking, you know, you could see it as him humoring the Zionists. You know, when somebody is completely insane, you just humor them. Okay, yeah, you're a woman. Go ahead and, you know, sit Mr. 6'4" swimmer. You know, whatever.
That's one way of dealing with them.
Right. So, Bobby Kennedy seems to be patting the crazy Zionists on the head and humoring them.
You know, but very seriously, when you're looking, that is off limits to all of these discussions. And certainly as far as the people who are pushing this agenda in the United States, you know, if it were simply a function of the accumulation of wealth, I doubt there's been a society in the world since the first collection of Neanderthals clustered around a cave and begin counting possessions of stone axes and clay pots and notice that one guy who just happened to be bigger than the others was accumulating more of the stone axes and more of the pots and more, therefore more of the women in the tribe. And that's been continuing right through history. That's happened in every society. I don't know of anyone where it hasn't. There have been very clear indications, though, that it's more than just the accumulation of wealth. That, yes, happening. That always happens in societies. As they become more developed, as they become more advanced for their level of industrial development, you see an accumulation of wealth and therefore power among an increasingly more defined smaller group of people. That happens. It would be nice in an ideal world that it didn't, but it does happen. It happens in Morocco as much as it happens in Michigan.
What do you think of Peter Turchin's model that, yes, all societies are ruled by either wealthy elites or military elites or some combination thereof, but there are differences in the extent to which they share the wealth with the common people? And the ones that learn how to share the wealth with the common people for a while, generally during their periods of thriving, are sharing. And then what happens is they forget and they start just grabbing it all for themselves, which sets off a bunch of mechanisms that predictably destroy those societies, as Turchin describes.
Well, that's one of the things that can happen. Another thing that can happen is that you begin with societies in which serving the state, you know, usually in the military, is not only an expectation of citizenship, but a perquisite of citizenship. And the citizens, you know, like in the Roman Republic, went through the catastrophic wars against Hannibal of Carthage, counted their dead, picked up their swords, and went back to it again. They did it again. The citizens, only the citizens. It was a purpose of a citizenship. Same in the Greek city-states. I guess it would be the equivalent of citizenship in Celtic Europe. But then it eventually the citizens became, I don't know, comfortable, converted, bored, and you moved away from citizenship and service being conjoined and citizenship and service to the country being separated. And it was that separation of citizenship and service that always made it possible for an increasingly small number of that elite to acquire power. The wealthy always did have leadership positions, but when leadership meant standing in the front rank of the legions, you know, and taking what the enemy had to give you, and having a rule, even at the time of Caesar and Cicero, first century BC, to enter the cursus honorum, the first level of political position, of elected political position in the Roman Republic, just before it collapsed and became the empire, you still had to serve 10 years in the legions or fight in 10 campaigns, period. And that was a prerequisite. And if you couldn't do it because of your health, you know, if you were blind, if you were lame, something like that, well, you didn't go into government service either. So you might still be wealthy. You could still be a wealthy merchant, and you might have a lot of influence over the people who did run the country, but you weren't going to be actually in power having the country. And there is always a potential difference between power and influence. Power over and influence on. Power over is clearer. If the two coincide, that's best for the people in power. But the two can be separated. And if they are separated, then you get a more complicated system. And I think once you begin separating citizenship from service to a country, that country is taking its steps down.
We've seen that in this country. It seems that there's no service ethic whatsoever among today's elite.
We've seen that in this country and in Western Europe as well, very clearly.
So, and that's tied in with the feminization you mentioned in your article.
That is part of the feminization. No, I'm not a big believer in military government or military rule. You know, it's fine, and sometimes it's necessary, sometimes for emergency purposes.
You have about 15 seconds left here.
Yeah, but the Japanese, before World War II and before and during World War II, would be a stellar example of the lesson of the being ill-advised to give the military control.
Okay, so there's no perfect system, but this gynocracy we're living under now is one of the more imperfect. So we're going to have to leave it there. That was a good basis.
A pedophile option.
It's looking that way. Absolutely. All right. Thanks, Alan. Take care. God bless.
Take care, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on The Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Hi, I'm Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern.